Live from Utrecht, this is Bitcoin
Explained.
Welcome back, Shores.
Thank you.
You were on holiday, that's why we were out for a couple of weeks. Where did you actually go?
I'm not going to say.
Is that your OpTech strategy?
Exactly.
Or just ashamed of where you went?
Both.
Okay, well, Bitcoin Amsterdam is coming up just a couple of months from now. You know what that means, right, Shores? A conference in Amsterdam. It means
having to go to Amsterdam.
It means 420 blaze it. That's why we're going to talk about hash today. Do you get it?
Oh,
yes. That's the first pun. The first pun of the new season. I'm going to consider it a new season and we're strong out of the gate with fresh new puns for our listeners.
I did expect you were going to make a pun around that topic. Yes.
We are going to talk about hashes. Hash functions, to be specific. This is a topic that has come up here and there, and it's obviously a topic that everyone knows something about.
Mm-hmm.
And you, our dear listener, might now think, where you're talking about hashes, we already know what hashes are. But do you really know what a hash is? I didn't. I thought I did, but I learned something in preparation for this show, so you might as well. Sure, so I'm going to start with the first basic question. I think most people have a general idea of what a hash is, but still, Shores, what is a hash?
Well, it's basically a function that goes in one way. It garbles the input. So if you start with the word hello, then out comes some garbage.
Yeah.
And if you start with the word hello too, out comes some different garbage.
Well, you say garbage, but what you really mean is a number.
Yes.
Data.
Yes.
Essentially zeros and ones.
Yes. But I mean, everything is zeros and ones, so that's why I'm saying.
A number.
Yeah.
Is exactly. That the best way to put it? A number comes out. A number goes in, a number comes out. And any data, you can convert any data, a picture or a song, or as long as it's digital, you can convert it into a number. And then you can put that number, you can hash that number and you get a different number, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, now there are some important properties for a hash function to be a hash function.
Yes.
You can't just say multiply everything by two. If you do that, you get a different number, but that's not a hash function.
Yeah, and
a
so
a hash function needs to do something specific. So what does it need to do?
Yeah, it needs to make sure that if you know the hash, like, you can't just change it, basically. Or maybe a better way to say it is, so if you have the word hello and you hash it, it comes out a number. And then you shouldn't just be able to say, well, I want to make hello too. I'm just going to change the hash now, and then I know that it was hello too.
Right. So what you're saying is,
so if in your example of multiplying by two, let's say that the hash of the word hello is one. And if the hash of the word hello too is two, well, it's a little bit too predictable.
Right.
I mean, that would be a weird example. Maybe a better example would be if the hash of the word hello, hello was two. You know, it'd be very predictable because now if you know, I can take the number three and I can guess, oh, then the original must be hello, hello, hello.
Yeah, so essentially, the outcome needs to be completely unpredictable. So if you change even this, if you hash an entire book, and then you hash the exact same book, but you change one period into a comma, the hash needs to be completely different, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And there needs to be no way to figure out which hash came from which book.
Yeah, well, in particular, like, it shouldn't...
Unless you have the book, I should add.
Yeah, I think one thing you want to prevent is the thing called collisions, right? So that means that if I take your book and now I change some comma in a very specific place, that I would get the same hash, that's a problem. Because then I could show you two different books and they would have the same hash. And so now I've cheated because the whole point of the hash was to prove that, you know, I was actually referring to the book and not some other book.
Right. So each piece of data should result in a different hash.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So that ties into my next question. And I'm not sure if we completely answered this question already, but so let's see if we did or didn't. What would it make? So some hash functions have been broken in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So what does it mean if a hash function is broken?
Yeah, so then we can get into some numbers, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say the resulting hash is a number with like it's 64 bytes or 256 bits, right? 256 bits, that's the hash. And that means there are 256 possibilities, right?
Yeah, and that bits are literally the zeros and ones that I mentioned earlier.
256 zeros and ones, that's the hash itself.
Yeah.
So that means that if you have some piece of text, say the word hello, and that results in this hash, now the question would be, can you find another word that results in the same hash?
Mm-hmm.
For example, the word hello too.
Mm-hmm.
And if the hash works really well, then you just have to guess. You would try, 2 to the power of 256 different words or different sentences until you get the same hash as hello. And that should take a very long time. Now, the hash is very broken if it doesn't take a very long time. If it turns out that you can just try maybe 100 different things and then you find a duplicate hash or a collision.
Right. So as soon as any hash collision is found, which has happened with previous, or I'm not sure why, with older hash functions. So as soon as any collision is found, is at that point the hash function considered broken?
I don't know what the exact criteria is, but you can try and measure it. So if, for example, it should take 2 to the power of 256 attempts, but in practice you can do it once in 100 times, then obviously it's broken. But if it takes 2 to the power of 255 attempts, that's still a huge number. So right. There might still be some practical limit. But if you're probably in the case of this, if you're able to find a single collision, that means the odds are already too high, because it should really never happen with that big of a number. It's such an astronomical number that it should take you longer than the age of the universe to try all these combinations. So if you find something in less than the age of the universe, that's a really bad sign.
And if you do find something, it was presumably in less time than the age of the universe.
Yes, because you're alive. And so in historical examples, there have been hash functions that were able to be broken earlier. See if I can find the list, or you might have it. Yes. So for example, there was MD5, I think. And MD5 was supposed to be 128 bit of hash. So that's 2 to the power of 128 attempts. That is a very long time. Not as long as 256.
Or the age of the universe.
But still, that's still age of the universe, longer than that. But 256 is even longer.
Right.
Yeah. But because 128 bits is the security of a 12-word mnemonic. So if you have 12 words written down, the 12-word seed, that is 128 bits.
Got it.
24 one is 256 bits.
Right.
So it's should be very, very secure. However, it turns out that somebody was able to find a collision with only 2 to the power 18 attempts.
Right, and I see.
That is roughly, I should not try to do that off my head, but I think it's less than a million.
Right. So in that case, the hash function is considered broken.
It's completely broken, because if you can, brute force a million different words on a computer, like a million different passwords, to guess what the hash means, that's nothing. You can do that in a very short time.
Yeah. And you just used the word brute force. Is that the only way to break a hash function in this way, or in this?
Brute force should not help you at all, right? Because that should take you the age of the universe.
No,
but it's usually a combination with some trick,
right?
Whatever that trick is, and then brute force.
Right. Yeah, that was going to be my question, indeed. So there's a more pointed way to try and break it. You're using some kind of strategy to break it, then.
Yeah, but you're still probably brute force looking, but you have a better idea where to look.
Right. Got it. Is this the only, or at least the main failure mode or failure model of a hash function?
Yeah, that's when the hash function itself would be considered a failure,
right?
But there are ways that you can use hashes that make you more prone to failure. So, for example, there are websites that store passwords. Well, they don't store the password. That's really bad. But there are websites that store the hash of a password.
Yeah, right.
And now let's say that hash is not very good, or even if it is very good, actually, somebody could make something called a rainbow table. So somebody would say, well, what if the last password is hello? What if the password is hello too? And they calculate the hash for each of these passwords. And then if you find a leaked database with all these passwords, you can very quickly guess which password belongs to which hash, because you have this lookup table.
Right. It's basically you're just entering passwords yourself, seeing what the hash is, and then remembering that. And then if someone pops up using that hash as a password, then you can link the two, right?
Yeah, and that's not a mistake in the hash function. That's just the way that you're using it. And the solution to that is called a salt, which means that every time you store a hash, before you do that, you add something to it, to the original text, like just the word salt or something, or 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you hash it. And then that means that these tables are of no use.
Right.
Which means the attacker will have to calculate, will have to guess a password and then do this calculation. It just makes it more work for the attacker.
So this reminds me of something that I've been wondering about for a while. And somehow I think this is going to be... Well, let's see. So I've always wondered about this, and I've never thought about it for much longer than 10 seconds, but maybe you have the answer.
Okay.
So when I enter a password, like I'm creating a new account on a website, and I'm entering my password there, and then the website tells me, no, that password is no good because you need to use a capital letter, and you need to use a number and a special whatever... If the website is only getting my hash, then how do they know I'm not using a capital letter or a number or any of that?
Well, if you're really lucky, then your browser is actually doing these checks. But usually, unfortunately, sadly, you are sending the actual password to the server. And the server is looking at that password, comparing it. When there's a new password, it's just looking at the password. And then it tells you what's wrong with it. The only thing
so
is
they're
that
storing it in a hash, ideally.
Yes.
But the first time you're creating your account, you're actually sending him your
plain text
password.
Yeah, and every time you log in.
That is sort of the easy answer to my question, and I was hoping that there was a more sophisticated solution. I was hoping they had a more sophisticated way of dealing with that, but basically you're just trusting them to not.
I'm
store
sure
your
there
password.
Are theoretically better ways to do this,
right.
But I don't think they're used. At least they're usually not used.
Okay, well, this was a little bit of an off-topic question. Let's move on to the probably most important question of this entire episode. Here it comes. So, Sjors, we've now explained what a hash does, but how does a hash do it? How does a hash function actually do it? Like, what's going on?
What's the magic sauce?
Yes.
Well, it really does... To me, it just looks like magic. So what happens is every piece of text that you put into a hash function, you can just represent as a series of zeros and ones, basically bits.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is the hash function will take little chunks of it. So we'll cut it into chunks, say, of 64 bits. It will cut the whole text in 64-bit chunks.
Mm-hmm.
And then it will say, okay, for each chunk, I'm going to look at the first bit, and I'm going to flip it around and move it to that third position. And then I'm going to take the second bit and I'm going to flip that around twice and move it to the first position. And I'm going to take the third bit and I'm going to not flip it around, but compare it to the first bit and say, I want the inverse of the two bits added up together or something like that. So you're basically just doing this random, well, not random, but specifically designed way of scrambling the original text. And you repeat that for every 64-bit chunk. And that results in this hash.
Right. So this is what I mentioned at the start of the episode. This was for me kind of probably the most surprising thing.
But it looks very much like sorcery or like, you know, whatever.
Well, but the thing is, it really isn't. Like, it's really just a design that was designed by someone with the specific intent of just shoveling bits around in a specific way.
Yeah, it's less elegant. Terms of design, it's not like they have an absolute formula of how to make something random. It's just that if you do these operations, people have found that is enough to make it really random.
Right, yeah. In my mind, there was some sort of elegant math trick or something. But when I was looking into it more closely, it really seemed like more mechanical. It is a designed algorithm by someone who does something deterministically, but then the result should be random as far as we can hope.
Well, it's predictably random, right? It's pseudo-random because for anything that goes in, you know exactly what's going to come out. So in that sense, it's not random. But it looks random if you plot it, for example. If you represent the output as a number, then on a chart, then the number might be 1, and then the number might be 256, and then the number might be 128, and that should look completely random, should look like noise.
Right, so that's the way to test it. You basically chart out the results, and just by looking at the chart, it should look random enough.
Exactly. I'm sure there's a more mathematical way to prove that. But yeah.
I guess so, yeah. But that's how you prove it, right? Yeah. Okay, and so there have been a number of hash functions. So which one does Bitcoin use?
Well, Bitcoin uses at least two or three. The most important one, I would say, is called SHA-256, which is part of the SHA-2 family.
Yeah, what does SHA stand for, Shores?
If you'd asked me that earlier, I would have told you.
Well, I can tell you, okay. Because I didn't know either, but it just stands for Secure Hash Algorithm.
Okay, that's impressive.
The little nuggets of knowledge you get from this podcast.
Exactly, and that proves that it is secure.
There you go.
Well, we'll get to that. There's such a thing as a non-secure hash, which is not always a bad thing. But yeah, the SHA-256 one is important. It basically means that whatever you throw into it, you'll get back 256 bits of data. And that happens to be the size of a transaction identifier, but also the size of a block hash, because a block hash is the SHA-256, or actually the double SHA-256. So you just do it twice of a block. The contents of a block.
Okay, before we get, because that will be the next and last part of the episode, I guess, is how hashes are used in Bitcoin. So we'll get there in 1 minute.
Okay.
But very briefly, before we get there, so there have been several hash functions since. So when was the first hash function introduced, invented, proposed?
As far as I know, in the 1970s. But yeah. I haven't done super deep research, but it's not that old. I think the general idea was known or was suspected that there are mathematical operations, which this is, that will take some input and will produce predictably garbage output, and that you cannot go back from the output to the input. So it's a one-way function.
Hang on, you just used the term one-way function. So one-way function is an umbrella term for mathematical tricks, functions that are easy to calculate in one way and harder in the opposite direction.
I would
say
impossible in the other direction. So this is distinct from the elliptic curve cryptography, where it's very hard to go one way. It's very easy to go from a public key to it's very easy to go from a private key to a public key. It's very hard to go from a public key to a private key, but it's mathematically it's possible.
Wait, so wouldn't you?
But a hash, it is not possible to go back.
Right, but wouldn't this is just how we apply terms. Maybe this is not the most interesting thing, but wouldn't you consider both one-way functions? Like, wouldn't one-way function be the umbrella term for both of these things?
It could be. I don't know if mathematicians look at it that way, so you'd have to ask them.
Sure.
I mean, they are different in the sense that one of them you can, in theory, go back from a mathematical point of view. It just goes both ways.
Mm-hmm.
And these hash functions, really, they don't go back.
Yeah, at least... Yeah, okay, got it. So a one-way function is an umbrella term, at least that's how you use it, for mathematical functions that can only go one way. And then a hash is a good example of that.
Yeah, and a very useful example of that, right? Because a simple one-way function could be take the input and then output zero, always. That's one way.
Sure, just right.
Not useful.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. As far as I know, one-way functions have been sort of considered and discussed within the circles of cryptographers since the early 70s. It's also what inspired Diffie and Hellman to come up with public key cryptography. And then the first hash functions were like the late 70s. And that evolved from, I think the first one, was it called MDA? Am I saying it right? MDA, yeah. I think that's what I had in mind as possibly the first one or the oldest one.
It could be much older, I think, because that's the 1990s, and I think there were some ones in the 1970s too. But
okay, possibly. But then, so where I'm getting at really is, so where does Bitcoin's hashing algorithm come from? Who designed it? How did it develop over the years? Because it started with MDA, I think, somehow, and then it evolved into SHA.
It may have started, like I said, with something even older, but generally what happens is somebody designs this hash function in the way we just described, and then it turns out there's a collision, or it's too easy to find collisions, and so somebody usually just tweaks it a little bit, like adds one little operation and flips another bit. You know, it takes the left bit and moves it to the right. And just a slight change, and then hope, praise that it works better. That seems to be. I'm sure I'm not doing it justice here, but generally they're constantly based on each other. So the other one that's in Bitcoin is.
I think MDA was designed, or at least based on the design by Ronald Rivest, which is also the R in RSA, one of the three designers of the RSA algorithm. And then that design inspired SHA, and wasn't SHA designed by the NSA? Didn't they have a hand in the design?
They always have a hand in all these things. I don't know those specific details, who is involved with what. What I do know is that
While we're discussing this, I have my phone in my hand and I'm scrolling through Wikipedia. I did this before the show, but I'm just making sure. It was designed by the NSA.
Okay.
Is this something we should be worried about?
This was the pre-Snowden NSA, right?
I mean, it was the NSA that was going to war encryption in the 90s.
Well, you wouldn't go to war over something if you thought it didn't work. But that wasn't about hash functions, I think. That was mostly about public key encryption.
Yeah, it was.
But what I was trying to say is that the Europeans didn't trust the NSA, and so they came up with this RIBE-MD, or I don't know how you would pronounce it, but it is basically a variation of SHA-2 or of SHA, where they just, you know, if you read the original paper, you can see, oh, yeah, we changed a few bit flips here and there, but we didn't want to deviate too much from the original algorithm because we know it works. But one of the problems is, you know, how do you pick these little bits and things and operations? It looks very arbitrary. And that means that, you know, if you don't trust the person who made it, you might be worried that they build in some sort of sneaky backdoor, some vulnerability that they know, but you don't know.
Yeah.
And then one way to defend against that is, well, there's two things. One is that the NSA would say, well, this is how we, you know, how we designed it, and that's all arbitrary, but here's like a series of numbers of like 1 plus 5 plus 17 plus like 15 different, like a very elegant looking series of numbers, and say, well, if you just add this to it, and then it still works. And that kind of proves like, well, these numbers are so elegant that they probably were chosen, you know, randomly or something. That's one way. And the other thing is you just change it. That they were. Or that the end result could not have been tempered with. Because you're saying you're adding so much stuff to it that is very hard, that makes it more difficult to design a malicious system. But it's still a bit hand-wavy. And the other thing you would do is what the Europeans did, I guess. They just changed it a bit. Not too much, but a little bit, so that any backdoor that might have been in there would be broken.
Right. Okay. Let's move on to what this podcast is, or at least promises to be about in the title. How does hashes really maybe the core fundamental building block for Bitcoin, wouldn't you say?
Well, it's certainly quite useful. Yeah.
It is used here and there.
Yeah.
So where are hashes used? Sure. So how do hashes help Bitcoin?
Well, for one thing, every block, if you take the entire contents of the block, that's hashed, and, you know, descriptively called the block hash.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that this hash of the block, well, first of all, the block itself consists of transactions, and so every transaction also has a hash. So that's two use cases.
Which is the transaction ID.
Yeah. Now blocks link to each other, so the, you know, one block links to the previous block, and the way it links to that block is using the hash of that block. Because the hash itself of a block is not in the blockchain. The block is in the blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
And then your computer just reads the block and then figures out, okay, this is the hash. And so the next block will mention that hash, and that's how you know that the next block actually builds on top of the first one.
Yeah.
This, again, is why you really don't want collisions, right? Because if it was possible to create another block with very different transactions in it with the same hash, you would have a problem.
Yo, what is going on, guys? We are proud to have Voltage as a sponsor of this episode. How many of you developers out there have wanted a streamlined infrastructure provider for your particular project? Well, I'll tell you what, Voltage is the Bitcoin infrastructure provider you have been looking for that makes building on Bitcoin quick and easy, whether it's Bitcoin nodes, Lightning nodes, BTC Pay, and so much more. But don't take it from me. Just ask the guys over at Amboss, Sphinx, Podcast Index, and Thunder Games, and so many others that you guys already know and love. Their enterprise-grade products make it fast and easy to build, deploy, and scale your next project. So make it easy on yourself. Even normie plebs can use the dashboard or API. Don't wait before the next block confirmation. Let your team focus on building great products and let Voltage handle all the rest. Voltage is your go-to zero management Bitcoin infrastructure solution.
Right. What would be the problem exactly?
Well, let's say the first block creates 25 Bitcoin and sends it to you, and everybody accepts that block and builds on top of it, and then that means you will have that Bitcoin forever, essentially, until you decide to move it. But now I come in and I create a new block where that 25 Bitcoin actually goes to me, and I find a way to produce the same hash of the block, which is impossible. But if I were able to produce the same hash, then I could send everybody else my block, and they would look at the hash and say, okay, that's definitely the valid hash of that second block in the blockchain. So all the blocks are still connected. So that means that existing users wouldn't be tricked in this case, right? Because they would already have the block and they have no reason to replace it.
Mm-hmm.
But any new person downloading the blockchain would be confused because they would just get the fake block. But it's not fake in any sense that the Bitcoin software cares about, because it would have the same hash.
Right.
So there would be two different blocks with the same hash with very different events, and that would be a complete disaster.
Right. So hashes are used to link blocks together into a blockchain.
Yep.
And then the other thing about a block hash is that it also determines whether the block itself is even valid in the first place.
Well, that's the proof of work part.
Right.
Right. So what happens is that this hash is just 256 bits. And so what you can do, and that's what proof of work essentially does, is it says the first several bits need to be zero, or roughly, like the whole hash needs to be lower than a certain number, but it doesn't really matter. You could see it as, okay, so we're going to require that the first 10 zeros, the first 10 bits of the block are zero. And then you can, because the only way to figure out what a hash is brute force, the only way to get 10 zeros is to just try 2^10 different things.
Yeah.
And so the thing you would change in the block, you'd have to change something in the block to get a different hash. And so one of the things you would change is the nonce in the header of the block. And
which is just a random number.
Yeah, exactly. That's just a random number.
Add a random number to a block, and then you get a different hash, and then you check if the hash is valid. If not, you try again with a new random number.
Yeah, exactly. And the one thing that's in the block is the timestamp. So every second, that timestamp changes as well. So there's a couple of things there, and there's some trouble around it that we don't have to go into.
Yeah.
But that's basically how the proof of work works.
Yeah.
It's using this fact that the hashes are random, which means you cannot, there's no way to say, I'm just going to put 10 zeros in front of this at the start of this hash and then figure out the rest of the hash later. You can't do that.
Right. Okay. So that's blocks, transactions. What one detail about transactions that's maybe kind of interesting to mention before we move on is that the hash of a transaction doesn't include the entire transaction, right? Because it doesn't include the signature, most notably.
Not in SegWit, yeah.
Because the signature needs to sign.
Well, because we want to be compatible with old nodes. Mm-hmm. So as far as all the nodes before SegWit is concerned, everything in the transaction is hashed. But as far as SegWit is concerned.
You can't. The signature was not hashed because then you can't sign the transaction.
That's different. So the signature, so there's two hashes involved here.
Right.
One is what I was describing is to refer to another transaction. That's right, using the hash, and that covers the entire transaction. Well, minus the SegWit stuff at the moment.
Okay, yeah.
And then the transaction itself has a signature, but the signature, of course, cannot refer to the signature itself. Mm-hmm. So in order to make a signature, you don't take the hash of the transaction. You take certain chunks of the transaction and leave the rest, you set it to zero, and then you sign that hash.
Right. So you take chunks out of the transaction, you hash that, and you sign that.
Yes.
And now the whole package is hashed again, which is what is referenced by other transactions. Am I saying that right now?
Yeah. So other transactions don't refer to the SegWit part of a transaction.
Right, right, right.
But the way that's solved is because in the Coinbase of every block, there is a hash that does refer to all these things.
Okay, so a hash is actually used twice, even in a single transaction.
Yeah, in multiple ways. Yeah, exactly.
In multiple ways, yeah. Okay, so that's blocks, transactions, proof of work. I think most people knew that, or at least kind of knew that. And then, but there's more ways in which hashes are used. So
yeah,
it's used now in Taproot.
Well, maybe easier to say. Well, yeah, in Taproot, that's right. For the if you have this tree with multiple conditions, multiple ways that you can spend the script, that tree uses hashes and that go into a Merkle tree. We've described that in a different episode.
Yeah, let's not get into the whole Merkle tree.
But that's where you have hashes. Again, SHA-256.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have addresses. Originally, anyway, addresses would you would start from a public key and then you would take the SHA-256 hash or double SHA-256 hash of the public key.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would take this European RIPMD hash of that hash and that would be your address.
Oh, that in that part of Bitcoin, or at least, yeah, that's where they used, we used, Bitcoin used the European?
Both. That may have been some like, well, I don't trust either thing by Satoshi. I haven't read the history of why he did both.
Oh, actually, Satoshi introduced that.
As far as I know, yes. This address format has been in there from the beginning. But with Taproot, there's no longer a hash involved in the address.
Okay, I see here in the notes that are hashes used in the random number generation part of...
In general?
I guess that would be creating private keys?
In general, when you create the seed, the randomness, that uses a random number generator. And mostly that's done by your computer itself, though there is also some code in Bitcoin that adds some extra randomness. And generally, random number generators use hash functions in all sorts of weird ways.
Mm-hmm.
Might be a little bit out of scope, but the idea is like because a computer doesn't have a way to actually throw dice, so it needs to get randomness somehow. And what it does tends to do is like it'll look at what time it is, it'll look what's on its hard drive, which would be the result of, you know, many months of random things happening to it. It might maybe look at the temperature sensor of the CPU or things like that, and then hash all those things. And hash those things again, and that's where the random numbers come from, more or less.
Right.
So
you mentioned that's something that your computer does, and then the Bitcoin software does it again.
Does it a little bit more. The idea is if you have some random data from one source, you can mix it with random data from the other source, and as long as one of those two sources is really random, you're fine. So it just makes it better. If you have bad random data and you mix it with good random data, the result is good random data.
Right. Anything else?
Well, yeah, the other thing is if you have a seed, so you start with the 12-word mnemonic in order to go from that to individual keys that are derived from your wallet, you know, unique addresses, that uses hashes too.
How does it use hashes?
Well, it derives like the next key from it. And I think that derivation involves a bunch of hashes inside of it to go from the private key to the next private key. It's not just plus one. It's like plus the hash of something, plus the hash of something else,
right.
Plus one.
So each new private key is basically a hash of a previous private key.
Higher up in the tree, yeah.
Right, right.
And another place where we use it, a little bit more fun, is the address bucketing system. We talked about Eclipse attacks many episodes ago.
Yeah.
And one of the things we described is that when a Bitcoin node learns about other Bitcoin nodes, it has to store all these IP addresses of the other nodes. And it doesn't store those in one giant list. It divides those over a bunch of buckets. And the way to decide which IP address that you've gossiped around, which IP address goes in which bucket, also involves a hash function. So you take a hash of the IP address and then you say, okay, if the hash is 1, it goes in bucket 1. If the hash is 2, it goes in bucket 2, etc.
Right, so it's basically a way to just get a random number in that sense.
And in this case, the security of the random number is not that important. So you don't need the secure hash algorithm, SHA. Mm-hmm. You can use a simpler hash function that is faster, basically, because that's the trade-off. Usually
right.
It's just you can do hashes faster, but then you're not going to get them perfectly random, but that's okay for this purpose.
So which one does it use?
I think this one's called SIP hash.
Got it.
Don't know what it stands for.
Is it designed for Bitcoin?
No, it's older.
Okay. This doesn't refer to SIPA?
No.
Okay, just making sure. Okay, so we've mentioned hashes are used in blocks, transactions, proof of work, which is also part of blocks, but either way, addresses, Merkle trees, the random number generation and
key derivation. It's used inside various cryptographic operations. So when you make a signature, right, you're hashing, you're making a hash before you sign it.
Plenty of hash in Bitcoin.
Yep, it's everywhere. Okay, I think that's all right.
I think so, it's yours. So
thank you for listening to Bitcoin
Explained.